Hi, everybody. This is Steven Siegel, and welcome back to the New Books Network and to New Books in East European Studies and New Books in Jewish Studies today. We have on our podcast a wonderful guest, the author of the book, Stepchildren of the Shtetl, The Destitute, Disabled, and Mad of Jewish Eastern Europe, 1800 to 1939, published by Stanford University Press in 2020. We're joined by Professor Natan Meir. Welcome to our podcast today, Natan.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So a little bit about Natan. He is the Laurie I. Loki Professor of Judaic Studies in the Harold Schnitzer Family Program in Judaic Studies at Portland State University, a scholar of the social and cultural history of East European Jewry. He's the author of Kyiv, Jewish Metropolis, A History, 1859 to 1914, published by Indiana University Press in 2010, in addition to our book today. He serves as a professor and a museum consultant and leads study tours of Eastern Europe with ILET Tours. It's wonderful to have you today. And I want to start with the first question about the book. What I particularly love about this book is your focus on the marginal peoples and how this notion was portrayed in the history of Jewish Eastern Europe. So what is it that got you interested in this particular topic?
Well, that's a question that I'm often asked, and I've answered it in a number of different ways over the years. I guess the standard answer is that it was a through line from my previous project on the Jews of Kyiv. And that book focused in large measure on the institutional life of the Jews of Kyiv. And specifically philanthropic institutions. So I became, although I didn't know it before I started the project of Kyiv, I became very interested in philanthropy and charity, and of course in the philanthropists as well. And one of the things that I noticed as I was reading through the annual reports of Jewish philanthropic organizations in the Russian Empire, well, in this case, in Kyiv in particular, was the fact that the beneficiaries of the charities, as you know, as probably won't be surprising to any of the listeners, usually went unnamed. Sometimes there were pictures of them, but they were mostly anonymous. Once in a while, there would be some sort of anecdote about a particular particular recipient of charity. So I became interested in these anonymous poor people, basically, and started wondering about this faceless, nameless mass of impoverished people who made up by the late 19th century pretty significant portion of Russian and Polish Jewry. And so that was the start of my foray into the world of the marginalized, you could also call it the underclass. And I guess another reason why I became interested in this topic in particular was my own experience as a gay man in the Jewish community, where I experienced some marginalization over the years. I mean, nothing on the order of what I describe in the book, but still, I was kind of curious about the role of people on the margins of community in Jewish history. And I think maybe that was an unconscious motivation at first, and I've become more aware of it as the project matured.
So let's talk about the poverty idea a little bit more and the underclass and how they're represented. I think your work, and correct me if I'm wrong, is now going much further back in time into the pre-modern period. And I was particularly struck by your coverage, which is very wide and I think broad, but also deep, of the historiography of Jewish charity and Jewish poverty. Could you talk about how poverty has been represented from the pre-modern to the modern in the Jewish historical experience?
Absolutely. This was something that really intrigued me. And I'm glad to hear you say that you found the coverage both broad and deep, because that was definitely a goal of mine. And it was just, by the by, it was exciting for me in this research project to be able to go back further in time, as you mentioned, than I had in my Kiev book. Because my training, my graduate training at Columbia, emphasized a mastery of all of Jewish history, which means that we had to take comprehensive exams, not only in modern history, which is my specialization, but also in ancient and medieval Jewish history. So, and I also teach broadly within Jewish history. So it's exciting for me to be able to explore other chronological eras other than the one that I'm most familiar with.
May I ask where is your beginning? What is the beginning of the book? Is it a time or a topic? Is it an actual date?
Well, say? I started. The date 1800, which is in the title, is really an approximation for the beginning of imperial Russian rule, which actually dates to a few years before that, but. The idea is that when the Russian state really begins to intervene in a serious way in internal Jewish life in the Russian Empire. So that's what 1800 represents. But as you indicated earlier, I start actually in the early modern period in the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, because in order to understand the place of marginal people in Jewish society, beggars and disabled people and orphans, you have to go back to the pre-modern roots of those ideas. But to get back to your original question about the historiography, and this actually relates to, I suppose, a larger mission of the book in some sense, because there's a generally, both within traditional Jewish historiography, and also in, I would say, in the Jewish community today, there's a kind of assumption that that the poor and the needy have always been taken care of within the Jewish community, that Jewish charity was always exemplary among whatever kind of society you looked at, the Jewish minority would always provide for its outcasts as wonderfully as possible, and generally there were no exceptions to this rule. And that's obviously a very, very rosy picture.
Yes,
so, I mean, it's certainly true that that there were in the Middle Ages there were extensive charitable institutions in the Jewish community, in part because the Jews knew that if they didn't provide for their own, no one else would provide for them. And it's also a defense mechanism as well, which is part of what I talk about in the book. And that becomes even more important in the modern period because having many, many poor people or people who are perceived as being outside the norm in some way reflects badly on your own group, your own minority group. And so there's the historiographical school, I suppose you could call it, which I talk about in the book, which tries to look at Jewish charity in a more realistic way, and understands that Jews are human like everyone else, and they sometimes treated poor people and other marginalized people well, and sometimes they did treat them so well. And often that boils down to what happens in many societies, certainly pre-modern societies, but it also continues into the modern period, which is to divide poor people, beggars, and others. And in part, the marginalized groups, sometimes the boundaries between them sometimes tend to blur. So sometimes we can draw neat distinctions between the beggars and people with disabilities and the mentally ill and the chronically ill. And other times, especially in traditional societies, those categories tend to overlap. Ultimately, yeah, it tended to boil down to a distinction between who is deserving of charity and who is not deserving. If you were, for example, in some cases, if you were considered to be an idler, you know, if you didn't work because you couldn't work, or maybe, you know, you were perceived as not wanting to work, then you were considered to be not worthy of charity. And of course, that's something that as I say those words, it's very, very germane even to, you know, today's headlines. But, you know, we don't have to go into that now.
Oh, we can go into that as much as you love, as much as you want to. I think we should. But I do want to pick up on some of your earlier chapters, and one of the points that you make, I think, continually in reading through the sources is the importance of getting against the grain, because of course, reading against the grain, I should say, in the Kahal and also in the Hevrel, in the charitable societies, which were really fixtures of these of medieval Jewish communities, it poses for historians such a challenge to read against the grain of the good charitable organizations. You have on the one level institutions who in many ways want to show themselves as being benevolent organizations and supporting orphans or the mad or the destitute. And on the other hand, the sources that you use, and this is really my question, we'll get a very different angle on that. It might be history from below, but I guess this is my question for you. How did you begin through all of your languages, which is really incredible, and in all of your sources, to get a different story of the underclass?
Well, first of all, in terms of languages, I'm in awe of you and your multiple languages, which include Hungarian, which I've been trying to learn and have not gotten very far.
It's ruined me, Natan, from doing everything else, but it's changed my life to do research in Hungarian. So I'm very proud of that. But please tell us about your sources and your languages.
So yes, the sources are a major question, because on the one hand, as I started this project, I wondered where I would find any kind of mention of these marginalized people, whether I would ever even find their voices recorded at all, because that was something that was particularly intriguing to me, was whether I could drill down deep enough or search wide enough to be able to find some fragment that recorded their voices talking, as opposed to what other people said that they were saying. And I'll come back to that in a second, but what I did was basically just kind of scour the library that I'm familiar with of sources in East European Jewish history, which basically means the press in Hebrew and Yiddish and Russian, and to some extent also in Polish, and memoirs and Yiskra books, which are memorial books that were compiled after the Holocaust, and communal records. I also went to archives in the former Soviet Union and in Israel, and the YIVO archive in New York, which is a very, very important archive of East European Jewish history and culture. So I tried to cast as wide a net as I could. And what I basically discovered is that there were little fragments in many places. So they were kind of everywhere in a certain sense, and yet they were also nowhere, which is one of the definings of my book as a whole, as you know, which is that they're kind of insinuated into the fabric of East European Jewish society. So these people, they're literally ubiquitous. You know, they're in every single town, right, every single right. shtetl, and they're in larger numbers. They're also found in the big cities, but at the same time, they're often invisible. And people often don't want to talk about them, or they would prefer to that they be housed in some institution, whether it's the Jewish poorhouse, the Hekdesh, or some other institution where they'll be out of view. And so that was really, I suppose, in some ways, surprising to me that especially in, for example, in literary sources in the press, they were all over the place. I mean, do a search for orphan in the Jewish press and you'll find thousands of hits. But the question is, and here's another very important point. Are they talking about real orphans, or are they talking about orphans on a literary or symbolic level? And that's something that became clear to me also very early on in the project, that then I had to kind of develop that idea that there's really two sides to this project, one of which is trying to understand what the real lives of these people were like, and also on the other hand, trying to understand how they are used as symbols or as icons by authors and by, you know, ideologues and politicians and social welfare workers. That can be a tough distinction to draw, actually, sometimes.
Yeah, I see a real tension in your book throughout between the social angle and the cultural angle. You know, like, let's say we take an expelled Jewish innkeeper from a village in the crownlands of the Kingdom of Poland, or someone carrying disease, and you have this in your cholera wedding chapter. How do you actually get at that person without a name sometimes and try and figure out what actually happened beyond just the representation? I don't know if this is a rhetorical question, but it seems to be something that you were working through many times over in your sources, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And in the end, I was disappointed, I guess, really, just to be perfectly honest, because I never really found those people's voices at all. Now, it's possible that if I had the Zitzfleisch to sit for, you know, more weeks and months in the Ukrainian archives, that and like some of my colleagues who I greatly admire, if I had been able to go through dozens or hundreds of police and judicial files, then I might have come upon some, because sometimes you have interviews there, you know, kind of interrogations where people will confess or they'll say things about their lives which are very revealing. But I still don't think, I went through some of those files, and I still don't think that they would have been the people that I'm focused on, because these were fundamentally people without voices. They were illiterate, and the society generally did not care about what they had to say. So why would it have recorded anything that they had to say, except for if perhaps it was to mock them, which is why literature became such an important source for me. And ultimately, no, that did not how I started out at all. I thought that I would have to, I was like, well, I'm coming across so many of these, you know, short stories and feuilletons in the Yiddish press about these beggars and orphans. I'm just going to have to discard all of these because none of them are really getting to what I want. And I ultimately discovered that it's literature, which, you know, that's not going to surprise many people, but it, you know, I should confess that it, I suppose on some level, yeah, it was surprising, yeah, to me that, that literature provided such an important window into these people's lives. Even if it's not, of course, as we know, a mimetic, transcription of what their lives were like. And so that's why ultimately, that's why Yiddish and Hebrew literature became such an important part of the study.
Right. And I do want to come back to the archives, but I want to give our listeners a better impression of your organization of the book. So you have seven chapters. What are they, and how did you decide to organize them?
Right. So excellent question. As anyone who's written a book knows, it can be maddening and frustrating to try to figure out what your organization is going to be. And as someone who just looks at the finished product, it seems quite organic, but actually it takes a long time to figure out how things are going to look in the end. And so basically the way it works is that the core of the book, which is four chapters at the core, is dedicated to understanding the experience and attitudes towards marginalized people in the Russian Empire from the around the 1840s, 1850s up until the very end of the empire. So those chapters are dedicated to those are more or less thematic. So they're dedicated to the Hekdesh, which is the Jewish poorhouse, the cholera wedding, which was a magical ritual that East European Jews invented in the early 19th century to ward off epidemics. And that is very important for me because at its center was the marrying off of marginalized individuals, outcasts of the community, in the cemetery, which was a very, very unusual practice for Judaism. And then I have two other chapters there, one of which talks about charity, Jewish charity, and Jewish charitable attitudes towards beggars and other marginal folks. And then another one which discusses the question of madness and how Jewish madmen and madwomen, as they were, it would have been called at the time, how they kind of fit into or did not fit into Jewish society as a whole. So those are the thematic chapters at the core. So I start off with two introductory chapters that kind of introduce the role of marginal people, both socially and culturally, in Jewish culture in Eastern Europe. And there's a second chapter that explores the roots of attitudes towards marginal folk in the early years of Jewish life under the Russian Empire. So all fundamentally from around 1800 to, let's say, the mid-1830s or 1840 or so. And then the last chapter goes beyond the imperial period into interwar Poland to try to understand how these themes, whether there's continuity or discontinuity, and as you can imagine, there's both, how they continue on into the 1920s and 1930s. And then I finish with a very short epilogue on the Holocaust period and then the post-war years. So for me, it was a totally new endeavor to try to cover a period this broad because my Kiev book was pretty focused on the late imperial period from the 1860s to 1914. And so here I'm starting basically in the 17th and 18th centuries and going all the way up in some sense, all the way up to the present. And that was both challenging and exciting.
Yeah, and I'm also interested in how you expanded your work geographically. Given the book that I read and love, Your History of Kiev. So it seems to me both within the pale and perhaps beyond in Europe, you actually have a much broader view. I mean, at one point, I remember a source which describes the Republic of Beggars of East European Jewry, the Ostjudische Bettlerrepublik. So were there places that you found, Natan, where you had kind of representative stories? And I think the scale really matters in this, both within the cities and the shtetl or shtetlek as an institution. So it's a question about geography. What did you find, let's say, revealing as you began to expand geographically?
Well, yeah, that's a question that I continue to have along the journey of this entire project over the past decade, because, I mean, fundamentally, what is East European Jewry, right? I mean, sometimes we're limited linguistically, depending on, you know, on who we are. So, I mean, I generally focus on the Pale of Settlement in the Russian Empire, and on the Kingdom of Poland. And by the way, focusing on the Kingdom of Poland as well is not at all a foregone conclusion, because, right. you know, there's also, there can Absolutely. Be, you know, linguistically and for many other reasons as well, there are people who stick to one or the other. It's only because of my more recent work with my recent work with museum projects, and for other reasons that I've become much, much more aware of the Polish presence within East European Jewry. And that has historically been underplayed and underemphasized, which is really a tragedy. And so I'm able to read in Polish to some extent. It's not as good as I would like it to be, but I definitely try to include Poland and the Polish sources within this project. And then, as you know, from your own research very well, probably better than I, the boundaries between these empires are sometimes not as clear as one might think, especially when you're talking about groups like the Jews who are transnational. And so at times I found myself looking at Austro-Hungarian sources. And then I realized that I really wanted to have this study include Galicia as well, which is, much of this period is part of the Austrian Empire. I can read German, but I can't read handwritten German. I just can't do it. I have to have someone else look at it. So I realized there's so much that I want to know about this project that lives across the border as well. And yet at a certain point, you just have to kind of draw the line somewhere, right? So that was one of the lines that I drew. But then, of course, I also discovered, and this pops up at certain points in the book, that these poor people, these destitute people, are often wandering, and beggars in this period and throughout history are often itinerant, and they don't always respect borders either. And they're often going to go where they think they can get better handouts. And in this case, that meant that often Russian and Polish Jews would go to Germany. And then I had to try to figure out, what were German Jews' response to these people? And how does that factor into this larger question of the image of the Ostjude, right? Because in this case, ultimately, that really plays a very important role, not only for German Jews themselves in understanding who they are and figuring out their self-image vis-a-vis that of the poor Russian or Polish Jew, but, and of course, as we would say in Hebrew, lahavdil, which means, you know, to make a very important distinction that also ends up playing a role in Nazi thought and Nazi propaganda as well.
Yeah, and we'll come to that point that you just mentioned about the this kind of stigma and the racism that's there as well attached to liminal figures and the reduction through categories of Jewish communities into non-persons. I want to save that question for a little bit later. Could you tell our listeners what a cholera wedding is, and if it happened, and if it's real? What was it? And this is really an ethnographic question. I mean, I'm thinking of Anski's writings, but also like the history Nathaniel Deutsch has written about. What was it, and is it real, and how did you figure that out?
Well, it was real, although when you first read it, you think it can't have been real. Because it is something that feels like it should be fiction, but it ain't. Although it was also fictionalized. So the cholera wedding was a apotropaic or a magical ritual intended to ward off evil. In this case, the evil of disease, the evil of an epidemic, and. The earliest mention we have of it, as far as I've been able to tell, is in the 1830s when there was the first cholera pandemic in the Russian Empire. And the earliest mentions of it talk about either a poor man and a poor woman or two orphans being married to each other in this cemetery. as a charm, if you like, right, as a remedy for the epidemic, to keep it away or to end the epidemic altogether. And then later on in the 1860s and in the waves of epidemic that followed, at various junctures, the cholera wedding expands, it seems, to include all categories of the people that I call the marginalized folk, which includes people with disabilities, I mean, physical disabilities, and the people who are mentally ill, the developmentally disabled to some extent, beggars, people who are not married but advanced in age. So those people were also considered strange or peculiar in the Jewish community. And they're married to each other in the cemetery. And that ritual continues, oh, let's see, all the way into the early 20th century, into the early 1920s. Of course, cholera is mostly a thing of the past by that point, but then we have Spanish flu, we have the typhus epidemics, and then it reappears in the Holocaust period. We also know that the ritual spreads in the late 19th century to Palestine and to the United States and Canada. It's just a very powerful ritual. And I say that because I think it's very multi-layered, and that's why I spend so much time trying to unpack it in the book and trying to understand from an anthropological point of view what it meant for the people who undertook it. And it also is incredibly long-lasting. And in fact, I thought that we had seen the last of it during World War II, but in March there was a COVID wedding in the ultra-Orthodox community of B'nai Brak in Israel.
Oh, I didn't know that. Really?
So wow. They married two orphans to each other under a black wedding canopy, which is kind of the material symbol of the cholera wedding.
Wow, I didn't know that. That's really interesting. I'm thinking about how you expand the definitions. I see the cholera wedding as a pivot point in your book, turning toward disability studies and a lot of the new research that's coming out. So that's what I want to ask you about next. You have a chapter on the madness and the mad, and you really begin by, let's say, reassessing the Yiddish canon. I think this is something as a big project that you're taking on in your larger work, and understanding how nationalist discourse is used, especially in reference to the disabled and the mad, or at least as they're portrayed. So could you elaborate on that a little bit? How you turn, let's say, later on in the book toward the larger political context of 1890s and 1900s and up and through World War I?
Sure, absolutely. So I'm not by disposition a historian of politics, although it tends to loom very large in my field in East European Jewish history. And really, there's no way of getting around politics. I guess I just have to make my peace with that, and that's okay because I figured out how to come to terms with that in the book. In fact, it ended up being very important. And it's not that I didn't want to talk about Zionism and Bundism and other forms of Jewish politics. It's just that I, because there's so much attention that's been given to political movements, especially Zionism, for obvious reasons, I'm very dedicated to trying to understand the Jewish experience in Eastern Europe from other perspectives. But in fact, as it turned out, the image of the East European Jew as fundamentally flawed, as crippled, as kind of the outcasts of humanity, ended up being a very, very important image for both Zionists and Jewish socialists. And they use them in slightly different ways, I suppose. But ultimately, especially for Zionists, what's most important is that, first of all, you identify all of East European Jewry in some sense as this outcast. So in previous eras, the outcasts had been just one segment of this Jewish society. And in fact, progressives and wealthy leaders of the Jewish community often tried to downplay the importance of those marginalized people. But the Jewish political movements that arise in the late 19th century say, wait a second, actually, this is really useful because we want to point to the fact that really all of Jewry, or at least East European Jews, lives in a very unnatural condition and in fact is the sick man of Eastern Europe. And so the figure mm-hmm. of the marginalized person yeah. really plays a very useful role for them. And then the second step, of course, is to say that sick person then has to be totally transformed and rehabilitated into something that into someone who is not disabled, into someone who is not downtrodden, but in fact is strong and upright and works the land and can stand up for himself. And so it's a very ambivalent attitude, as you understand, right? It's both embracing the idea of the marginalized, but also at the same time rejecting it altogether.
Yeah, just to follow up on that, and we're talking about Zionism here, not just as an ideology, but I think as a movement. So were there particular writers that you came across in your sources who were relying, let's say, exclusively on stereotypes? I mean, did they read the sources carefully, these kinds of sources that you're talking about? What I'm asking is really a political question, of course, and you read that correctly, but It's a story of regeneration that has so many different levels and scales to it. Could you talk about that? I mean, what sort of sources that you used, especially in literature, in order to get at that question, that problem?
Well, one that comes to mind right away, which is not actually literature, but I can come back to the question of literary sources, is a leader in the Jewish medical field in the profession of psychiatry in Poland in the early 20th century by the name of Weisel, who was kind of a pioneer in trying to understand madness and insanity from a much more compassionate perspective. And he was one of the founders of a philanthropic organization based in Warsaw that aimed to help and support people with mental illness in the Jewish community, of course. And some of what he wrote seems so ahead of his time in terms of understanding the plight of people with mental illness and almost categorizing them in a way that's similar to the way that socialist parties would understand the proletariat. You know, this is another element of society that is oppressed, that needs to be lifted up, that needs to be understood, that needs to be supported. And that was really surprising to me that you could find that in 1905, 1906, that kind of understanding. In terms of literary sources, one of the most important for me is Peretz, the great Yiddish writer I.L. Peretz, who was active in the late 19th or early 20th centuries. And he wrote several pieces about madness that I found really intriguing. One of them is an attempt to try to get inside the mind of a mad person. He goes into a fictional insane asylum and kind of explores the territory of the insane asylum and the different characters that he finds there. And of course, this could be interpreted in all kinds of different ways. It doesn't necessarily have to be understood literally as parrots trying to understand madness, but it made sense to me, of course, and it was useful for my own project to try to see it that way and to understand how he delves into that world and tries to understand it on its own terms, which is something, again, that's pretty rare for that period, because generally you would read, especially in the press, accounts of madmen and madwomen that tended to be quite dismissive, I know, at the very best, and often mocking or denigrating in other ways. And Peretz in some ways really tries to understand them on their own terms. And that for me is an example of how the literary works, how these great writers like Peretz and like Mendel Mochersforim, Abramovich, who was another great Yiddish writer, really try to get inside of this, the world of the outcasts. And then obviously because their work is so, such high quality writing and ultimately has such a wide audience, that means that they are bringing that depth of understanding to the larger Jewish world, which of course is that should be the goal of any great writing, right? Is to expose something that people don't understand well and give them a really profound understanding of what that other experience is all about.
Yeah, and I definitely see that, Natan, if I may say so, in the later part of your chapter and into the epilogue, you are also seizing upon the compassion of a lot of these writers, and Abramovich and Peretz are two excellent examples. Yulian Tuvim is another one, Svobodavichi. This poem that you mentioned, which is a very moving poem, called Little Jew Boy Zidek, written in 1936. I think you argue, and you actually say, I think quite convincingly, and these are your own words, if I'm going to point to a page 226, it's in an echo of Abramovich and Peretz, Tuvim's poem Zidek embodies a renunciation of a Jewish self-hatred that replicates anti-Semitic stereotypes. I'm just going to ask for your commentary. Moreover, Peretz had insisted on the relevance of the madman's vision as counterpart to the hollow promises of nationalist scientific modernity. Now it seemed insanity was to be the condition of the entire nation. And I love the sentence, in a world gone mad and true madness had not yet even arrived, the mad were the only truly rational ones.
Right.
And just your commentary.
So this is where, you know, it's one of those moments where you're in your research and you're like, yes, this is it. I got it. It all makes sense now because it comes full circle, you see? Because earlier in the book, in the earliest chapters, I talk about in the pre-modern understanding of Jewish, of madness, for example, there's an element of the supernatural, of the mad person as having access to the world beyond, to prophecy, for example. And then we go through this period in the 19th century, which is very, very rooted in you know, Western scientific enlightenment ideas about what you do with people who are mad. And normally what you do is you lock them away or you try to cure them or something like that. And then ultimately we come back to, and that's the part that you were just reading, in the interwar period, and especially in the fields of folklore and in Belles Lettres, you come to this realization that there is something really unique and important for the human condition in these people whose experiences are not like the mainstream. You know, so the mad, for example, right? And kind of in a sense embracing the characterization of Jews as other, you know, whatever kind of other that might be, whether it's physical or whether it's mental, embracing the positive aspects of that, as Tuvim does in this poem, where he says, he calls at the very end, he refers to all of us, we singing Jews, we Jews possessed, even though he himself was, had not grown up in the milieu of the poor beggar who he describes in the courtyard. And yet he acknowledges that ultimately all Eastern European Jews are in the same plight. And we all have to acknowledge that we're in this together. And however people characterize us from the outside, or however we characterize ourselves, we East European Jews, we're all going to be part of that fate together, which is ultimately, tragically, that is literally what ends up happening during the Nazi occupation of Poland, because they do transform East European Jews into literal beggars and orphans and madmen, even though previously what I'm talking about is more of on the symbolic level, the kind of reclamation of that outcast identity.
Yeah. And I think your inclusion of the disciplines in a very interdisciplinary or transdisciplinary way of queer studies as well as disability studies is an innovation in this book. Because you end in 1939, but as you say, it's an almost unbridgeable gap. The stereotypes that then the Nazis have in the film, the poster, the Eternal Jew, and so forth. I mean, these are all representations of the body. And I wonder, the disabled body, let's say, I wonder if you could say a few words, therefore, about the jump from 1939 to now 2020. I mean, what can we learn in a larger perspective? What can our listeners know from your book, from your main points in your argument and your use of queer studies and disability studies?
Well, I think what I discovered at the end of the project, and that was obviously when I wrote the conclusion and was able to understand what I had done in a much broader way. And it's about centering the margins. I guess in some sense I had known that all along, because that's what the project tries to do. It tries to bring the marginalized back to the center. And in some cases, as we've mentioned in this discussion, they actually appear at the center of societal discourse, even though they're actually physically on the margins. But it's about, and this is, I think, what queer studies and what critical disability studies are also trying to do, is to understand that studying the people who are ostensibly on the margins of society, and yes, in some cases they really truly are marginalized. I mean, actually, in most cases. But when we look at it from a slightly different angle, you can understand this larger society so much better when you understand how it views its outcasts. You also understand that society better when you understand the experience of those outcasts themselves, to the extent that you can get to it. And that's what's so, in the end, what really confirmed my own instinct about embarking on this project in the first place was that I realized, okay, because at some certain points along the way, as often happens in a project, you question yourself, you think, does anyone really care about this? Or people know that you're working on this for many years and they say, oh yeah, Natan's working on the margins. He's a friend of mine, used to say he works on the Nebishes, he works on the Shlemiels. There's all kinds of Yiddish words to describe people who are kind of not so much with it. But then you realize, okay, you know what? This actually is really important. And like I said before, it's really about bringing to the center groups that that people perceive as being not important. And that's the connection to today's world, is that, and this is something that just struck me when I was giving talks in the last few months about the cholera wedding. As we're going through various stages of the pandemic, and I'm thinking more about epidemics and about the ritual of the cholera wedding itself and the role of the marginalized. And for me, it became very clear that what our society was doing, or at least the leadership, as far as I can tell, was saying, to hell with the marginalized. You know, it may be that people of color and poor people are going to suffer more from COVID-19, as we know is the case. But, you know, we got to open up again. That's just the way it is. And if people, you know, if there's collateral damage, then there's collateral damage. And that to me was such a strong parallel to what I saw in my own material of people using the marginalized people as a way of kind of fighting against the epidemic and again, as collateral damage. And I just wish there weren't such strong through lines, because, you know, that would signify we've come some way from the cholera wedding in the 19th century, but you know, we haven't come that far. And that's yeah. really a tragedy.
Yeah. And I'm also struck by how much history is forgotten. John Davis's book, Russia in the Time of Cholera, Disease Under the Romanovs and Soviets, is a good example. I mean, this is a book published in 2018. People forget that there are resources and historians to read like you, to pick up on this and to study it and how these reactions have taken place in the past. Natan, I have to ask you as a last question, is there something that you're working on now? What are you working on now? And also for our listeners, if you might be able to recommend similar books or other books on this topic or your new topic.
Well, I am embarking on a new project which is not fully formulated yet, but has something to do with the intersection of Jewish culture and religion, magic and sexuality and gender. I became very interested in Jewish magic over the course of researching the book on the stepchildren of the shtetl, and came across some really fascinating sources that I was not able to use in the book, but that I'm working on right now. For example, I'm trying to analyze a Hasidic tale that has very strong themes of homoerotic desire and magic, especially relating to kind of connection or relations between Jews and Christians. So that's kind of where I'm headed right now. I'm not really sure where it's going to go, but As I mentioned earlier, the instinct, right? The historian's instinct. And I, at this point in my career, I feel like I can trust it. So I'm going to go with it.
Yeah, you should. You should. You're a full professor. You should do that.
Right. I guess that's one of the prerogatives.
Yeah.
So in terms of books that I would recommend, so there's a very recent publication called A Rainbow Thread, an anthology of queer Jewish texts from the first century to the present. And that's just it was put together by my colleague Noam Siena, and it's just a remarkable collection of sources from throughout Jewish history relating to the queer Jewish experience. Something that, you know, 20 years ago we never could have imagined would have been able to exist, and here it is. And that's something that I'm going through as part of this new project that embraces sexuality as well. I guess I would probably also point to Naomi Seidman's book, which is actually now not so recent, because she's published a new one in the meantime, because she's prolific. But her book, The Marriage Plot, or How Jews Fell in Love with Love and with Literature. So that's a really, really important work in Jewish studies. that embraces history and culture and sexuality. So there's all kinds of really, really fantastic stuff in there.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm feverishly writing these down myself right now. So I hope our listeners will follow up, especially when, you know, the day libraries open again, and find all of these works. So thank you for those. So this is Steven Siegel, and I'm your host here on New Books in History and the New Books Network. We're on the podcast channels today, New Books in Eastern European Studies and New Books in Jewish Studies. And we've been speaking with Professor Natan Meir, who is a professor at Portland State University. And he is the author of the book we've been discussing today, Stepchildren of the Shtetl, The Destitute, Disabled, and Mad of Jewish Eastern Europe, 1800 to 1939, published by Stanford University Press in 2020. I want to congratulate Professor Meir again and thank him for joining us on the podcast. Thanks.
Thanks. This was so much fun.